I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a brightly lit rooftop at midnight here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Cove.
And with us again, back for her second film on this podcast is Chandler Levack. I'm sorry, I didn't ask for the pronunciation again. I'm, as I said, I don't even lead this podcast. Levack, right?
No, it's Levack.
Idiot. I'm an idiot. Levack. You know how I should have known? Because Levack is back.
Yeah, Levack is back.
Back on the pod. Canada. And you know what? You're back for the second pod that you've done where I've introduced it from a rooftop.
This is true.
I remember Guinevere, I also introduced from a rooftop. Mm-hmm. And this is also has a climactic rooftop scene in Last Night.
What are these Canadians thinking?
Well, exactly. You know what they're thinking? They're thinking, I'm going to make movies that Kenny's never seen nor heard of that are immediately going to shoot to like the top of his all-time list. spoiler alert, This is one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. I think this is, and here's another thing I want to say. Mm-hmm. So about the movie Levack is back for
Don McKellar directed this film. It's called Last Night. It stars Don McKellar and Sandra Oh. It's about the last night of the world. The world is ending at midnight. Phenomenon we don't really know, but I assume basically the sun is going to crash into the world, considering it is brightly lit in the middle of the night. And I don't think this is a perfect film, but I do think this is one of my favorite films. I think this is one of the one of the few films I've ever seen that speaks directly to me, directly to my heart. It is about the themes of this film, and the plight of the main character is something that I feel intimately acquainted with. And this is an entree for me, at least, to speak about favorite versus best. Because after watching a film like this, I feel like dropping the invisible curtain between favorite and best. And best is, to me, almost a stupid designation. You are only there is no such thing as objectivity when a person engages with art. There's only subjectivity. And my subjective view of this film is that this is a perfect film for me. And I will get into that as I go. But I was wowed and I cried and I loved every fucking minute of this film, even though it's a mess at times. Chandler, what's your experience with Last Night?
I believe that I saw it in high school and it immediately changed my life. I'd never seen anything like it. I loved it. I also equally cried, was scandalized at times, was very moved. And it was like kind of the perfect entree, I think, when you're sort of like in high school, but you are starting to venture out to like the foreign film sections of your local Blockbuster. And it just wowed me. And it wowed me that it was made in Canada. Sandra Oh, like performance utterly wowed me. And it just, it remains one of my favorite movies ever. Like, I just think it's phenomenal.
It's funny. I saw it when it came out. So probably either, I mean, it came out in Canada in 98, came out in the United States in 99, which is why we're covering it. But I don't think I saw it in the theater. I think I saw it probably my first year of film school. And it certainly felt like the type of movie that you can watch and felt makeable. Do you know what I mean? Like, it felt like the type of thing that, first of all, it's the type of film.
Good point.
Yeah. Like, it's a type of film that excuse me, that I gravitate towards, which is a talky movie where people are talking about their emotions in articulate ways and interesting ways. It's got a Linklater-y kind of vibe to it in that way. So I think I certainly gravitated towards that, but also, you know, again, either in first year of film school or certainly approaching it, it felt like a movie that I was like, well, maybe I could do this. Like, this doesn't seem, from a filmmaking, quote unquote, filmmaking perspective, it didn't seem impossible, where so many films that you watch that you love do seem impossible to make. It also, you know, it takes place in the city that I grew up in, and it just sort of, it felt so tangible. You know, it literally takes place in the annex. Most of the movie is shot in the annex, which is a area that I'm sure Chandler is well acquainted with, that you've seen in Scott Pilgrim and numerous other movies. It's sort of Bathurst and bluer-ish area. And it felt really genuine and grounded, and it's a really beautiful movie, and we'll obviously talk about the plot of it, but the end of the movie, the last scene, is so, like, it's just it is the thing I've always, that has stayed with me, that sort of like really stuck with me, is that beautiful final image that we'll talk about. But I don't know, I think that it also just I mean, it's such a Canadian movie, it is just brimming with like Canadian actors.
I love the Canadians. I don't know. First of all,
yes,
as an American, Canadian, and straight up, like, you know, an American film nerd to some extent, Canadian films are Goyen and Cronenberg, and that's all you get. I didn't know this existed. Right?
That's what you get.
That's all we get. I mean, Villeneuve now.
Other Canadian film. There's other countries there's other provinces in Canada too where they also.
Of course. I mean, of course. That's my point.
It's the only ones that have registered down here, I think.
Yeah, they're the only one. No, they're the only ones that who have registered as Canadian. You know what I mean? Like, there are obviously other Canadian filmmakers and certainly other Canadian actors who've gravitated or migrated down to the lower 48 and have kind of, you know, lost their Canadian essence, right? I don't think people look at Seth Rogen and say, there's a great Canadian actor. So I think that, but that's not really even what I'm talking about. Like, this just didn't make any kind of mark here. And that's very disappointing because this is an incredibly excellent film. Excellent film that would have affected me. It reminds me a little bit of my experience with Girl on the Bridge, mm-hmm. which would have like
changed your life, as you mentioned.
Jump started me as a filmmaker, sure, right? Sure. Or as a budding filmmaker, which would have changed my perspective of what you could do as a filmmaker and open my eyes. That's not what this film is for me. Mm. This film speaks directly to me as a person, which is better, right? That's what movies are supposed to do. And I forgot for a minute, like in the beginning, I'm taking notes and I'm thinking, you know, one of the things I wrote was like, this is the most independent film we've done. Even though the answer really is Blair Witch, but Blair Witch doesn't even count. It's a phenomenon. It's a different thing. But this, like, we just did Sex Lies and Videotape on the 89 pod, which is your quintessential indie film, which stars James Spader, who is already a massive star, right? This is a real independent film that looks like it was made on a shoestring budget, despite a few interesting FX shots that we can go into. You know, the way it's lit, the way it's shot, I didn't like it initially. Like, I can, you know, the themes were always resonant, and the tone was interesting, and the premise is directly at my heart. But the way it was shot felt very cheap, mm-hmm. and that is something that you had to grapple with. But I am telling you, I'm giving it no extra points, no bonus points. At the end of the day, because I think it was made cheaply. I'm giving it bonus points only because it's super excellent and probably better than any other film we've done this year. Okay.
Because it cost $2.5 million, which in the late 90s would be, I don't know, you know, if you factor in inflation and stuff, that's certainly a lot more.
And you could tell, like, you could tell
Canada
as you go
prestige picture.
I know, and you could tell as you go on where that money was spent. It's not easy to block off streets. It's not easy to make the place look like it's falling. You know, like the world is ending. It's not easy to have large crowd shots. It's not easy to have a car, you know, vertical on the street. These kind of things. But the way and at the end, you know, you don't know what's happening at the beginning of the movie, but at the end, you understand why it's lit the way it's lit. Right? Like that was a decision, kind of like my room right now. That was a decision that wasn't, you know, a product of like a lighting guy who doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, so, it's funny because I actually had that thought because I couldn't remember why it was happening, like what the why the world was ending necessarily.
Yeah.
But about halfway through the film, I was like, why is it so fucking bright still? Like, it's 11 o'clock at night. Like, what's going on? And I appreciated that at the end, they kind of, I mean, they just basically says, you know, I miss nighttime. But if I have a nitpicky thing, it might be that, in the sense that I kind of think that from a mood perspective, it was a little weird to have the sun all the time. And I'm not sure it was weird in the best way. Again, like this is a nitpicky thing. I don't really care, but I don't know what you guys thought about
it. It feels like a budget decision.
That's what I think too.
The producers being like, okay, well, we can get more daylight if we shoot it. Can't it just all be in one day? And he's like, but if we have to show the night, it's last night. Well, what if it's like a sci-fi thing and the sun's actually
totally.
And it's the best kind of budget decision. Oh,
really? That sounds insane. Yeah. And then he's like, just write it. Just try it. You're the creative. I don't want to infringe on that.
But that's the best kind of budget decision, right? One that actually works its way organically into the plot. Mm-hmm. It's tough that this is literally what the Ralph Fiennes Sunshine is about. So it's not like we have not had, you know, the notion of the sun enveloping us as the end of the world out there. Sure.
Or so, Melancholia is kind of like
Melancholia, that. Melancholia is also about a very bright thing enveloping the earth.
About to take over the earth, yeah.
It's not the sun, but still, like, and again, we don't know this is the sun. It could be a meteor. I have no fucking idea what it is. It's burning up in the atmosphere. But the point is, like, this, if this was done for budgetary reasons, more power to them. Because I think this allowed you to have, And I think this is a thematic decision, and it speaks to why I love this movie so much. It's kind of a fade, but it's like something between like a you can't really fade to white, but it's like a smash to white, but a slow smash to white, which is so much more keeping with the spirit of the end of this movie than a smash to black would be. Mm-hmm. So
I think there's also, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, Chandler, in terms of Don McKellar's voice as an actor, voice as a writer, director. Kenny, I think the only other time you've seen him was in Existence.
Yeah, and I guess we'll see him in the Red Violin when we do it.
Correct,
which
correct.
Co-wrote, but
he's
another Canadian film. I had no idea was Canadian.
I love how you're just like, only you could only see these movies if you had to physically watch every single movie released in 1999.
It's 100% true, though.
But McKellar has a very interesting, I mean, Twitch City, which is a show that Kenny, I think you'd actually really like. It's a very strange half-hour comedy that Don McKellar did for the CBC. I think there might be a total of 18 episodes of it, if that. I have it on DVD. You can absolutely borrow it. It's bizarre, and it's about a guy who basically never leaves his apartment and is obsessed with television. Molly Parker's in it, as is...
That's my dream.
but I do think that he has such an interesting sense of humor that I do think is very Canadian, in the sense of it being sort of droll and kind of off kilter, but in a way that is polite and doesn't feel too alienating. and I think that, like, that's watching this again for the first time, honestly, in 20 years, the first dinner scene, the Christmas dinner scene, is so odd and so awkward and filled with so much sort of cringy moments and emotional moments, and really kind of encapsulates the odd tone that this movie is trying to navigate. And sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. But his delivery, Don McKellar as the lead, is kind of weird too. Like, he's a very strange hero. Hero, I put in quotation marks, a protagonist to follow through this movie in a good way. It's just emblematic of Canadian movies. Like, Kenny was talking about how this movie obviously didn't make much of an impression down here, even though Roger Ebert reviewed it, God bless him. He has not reviewed bigger movies in 1999, so I'll take that as a good thing. But
yeah, it screened at Cannes. It won Don McKellar an award at Cannes, you know, and I guess for context, like, Don McKellar,
yes,
you know, started out, like, he's an actor, he's a writer, he works in theater, he was one of the writers of The Drowsy Chaperone, that was like a huge Broadway musical. He has collaborated with like Adam McGoyan a lot, and was in Exotica. And
oh, that's right, he wasn't that. Exotica's a great movie. We have a Adam McGoyan film as well, Kenny, which you'll be watching this year in Felicia's Journey. So you've got another.
Canadian I know. Film. I get a little Hoskins. But obviously, but it's not a really Canadian set, interestingly enough.
No,
I'm trying to think what Don McKellar is. Like, is he our Canadian Woody Allen? He's sort of...
Oh, boy. That's a damning thing.
In a non-problematic way, but like in a way that he's writing vehicles for himself to star in, and he's the writer-director of it.
I honestly think... Linklater... I mean, Linklater doesn't act in his film, so maybe that's the wrong connection. I know what you're saying in the sense of him, he does make vehicles for himself. I also think it should be said too, like, and this is not a slight on Don McKellar, but he doesn't look like a movie star either. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't, his presence is very, again, meek. You know what I mean? Like he doesn't demand your attention, which is an interesting choice. Yeah.
I want to get into this. Okay. Yeah. So I have so many feelings about this because I think everything was great. All right. So is he Woody Allen? I don't think so.
Right.
Woody Allen is in love with himself. And Woody Allen has decided that Woody Allen, all you know, warts and all, is an appropriate leading man for films.
Especially young women.
Yeah, especially with young women, right? Yeah, and I don't think that's a throwaway. I think that's part of this thesis that I'm presenting, which is he has decided that Woody Allen is an appropriate leading man for these movies, that Woody Allen is the kind of person that can, you know, attract a Mariel Hemingway, can attract a
Scarlett Johansson.
Do they actually sleep together in a movie?
Aren't they in a movie together? Aren't they in Scoop together?
Is he
or
in
no?
Scoop? I don't think she's
a kindly magician to
she's Scarlett. Not like the, I mean,
he's
that
like
was
a
not
reporter.
Again, not he defending like, this
he is Jackman, not Woody Allen.
Okay, good. Sorry,
not defending this guy at all, but that was the first actress I think that he was like, that would be too unrealistic. I remember that being like that. He's
that's
like,
the line.
No one would buy it, right?
Yeah.
Even though, like, you know, he was with like fucking, you know, who was he with in someone ridiculous? He was like with like in
with Julia Roberts Harry. in Everyone Says I Love You.
Yeah,
right.
And
Mira Sorvino.
Oh my God.
Who died to get into bed with him in that movie. He's like, no. She's like, yes. So the point I'm making is like he expects the audience to accept him as a leading man, which, by the way, is like not what's the word I'm looking for? It's not self-defeating, right? It's not like
self-deprecating.
Like, no, it's not self-defeating. Like, that doesn't destroy the movie.
Oh, sure.
It's not necessarily something that like you have to explain your presence in a movie as a leading man if you look like Woody Allen, right? But you know, it does help a little bit. Right? It does help a little bit if you do have a discussion somewhere within the context of the movie of this is why in this world, a guy like Woody Allen is treated like he's like he's Brad Pitt. This is why. Okay. Don McKellar does that in this film. You go through an hour and 10 minutes of this film where you're kind of like, all right, this is an unusual way in. This is an unusual protagonist. This is an unusual guy that we're spending the last hours on Earth with. Mm-hmm. And then he explains it to you. And that's my favorite scene of the movie. So when you say, Phil, the dinner is odd, it undoubtedly is odd.
Yeah.
But that's my experience with my family. Right? That dinner scene, the sitting in the living room, him getting there late and getting, you know, kind of passive aggressively, you know, taking a task for it. His mom breaking down because he's not spending the last hours on Earth with him. Like, my parents listen to this podcast, so they might get upset when I say this. But my parents have twice canceled Thanksgiving because I am going to spend it with my wife's family. They didn't do Thanksgiving. Wow. So I can relate to a situation where the happiness of an entire family is put on one member of the family. Okay. So then
I'll take that
a step further. Cause that felt very real to me. Sure. Breaking it on the table. Mm. Now I'll take that a step further. When he says to Sandra Oh, that you have to meet my family to understand this. But my ex-girlfriend or ex-wife, we don't know who the person is who died, but he had a love who died. But she showed me that I didn't know how much I can love, and it turns out I can love a lot. Okay. Yeah, that's great something life. I feel too. Very strongly, right? Sure. Which is, you know, this is getting into some anywhere but here territory for me where I might have to like sort of stop the podcast and like process what I'm going through. But yes, that very much felt like my experience, where for 25 years of my life, I didn't really understand what it felt like to love someone or be loved in that way. Now, mm-hmm. I'm going to take it a step further.
Okay.
If my wife died, and I was texting this to her during the movie, she didn't watch with me. But if my wife died, my feeling will be, or would be, the world may as well end.
Oh.
So that is, and it's not, and I want to like, draw a very clear line between I should kill myself versus the world should end. My feeling sure. is not if my wife died, I should kill myself. My feeling
everyone
is
everyone should die.
No, just like it's over. Like that's it.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
yeah. And then I want to take it a step further.
It's your podcast.
This movie is ultimately about how crazy that feeling is mm-hmm. and how it's never actually over until the last fucking moment. It's never actually over. And he ends his life and the world ends on this unfucking speakable high. This unspeakable high. It is the most fucking optimistic movie for like brutally depressed people like me who have like, you know, I've mentioned on the, who have like, I've literally gone into fucking programs for it. Thank you both for being Canadian and being part of a country and a culture for that, that gave me this film. All right, I'm done.
I want to say, first of all, you know, it's
we're very moved to the country of Canada. Thanks, Drew. To your
country. I mean, I think that's, first of all, obviously it's a really beautiful sentiment. And I think that, you know, I agree with you, Kenny, in the sense that I also kind of locked into this film on an emotional level. I'm not married, as our listeners very well know. But I did think that this was the most optimistic movie about the end of the world that
possible.
You really could. I mean, there's obviously some, you know, David Cronenberg's fate is not exactly lovely, but for the most part, and we'll get into that, but for the most part, I do think that, it's such a Canadian movie. Like there's in the Roger Ebert review, I'm just going to read a little bit of it at the end here.
I'll do all the context,
but I want to specifically land on this, just this one sentence. At the end of the review, he talks about how he went to the Toronto Film Festival. And someone asked him if he could differentiate between American and Canadian films. And Ebert said that he couldn't. But another guest, Wayne Carlson, said, Sandra Goh goes into a grocery store to find a bottle of wine for dinner. The store has been looted. She finds two bottles still on the shelf. She takes them down, evaluates them, chooses one, puts the other one down politely back on the shelf. That's how you know it's a Canadian film. And I do think that there's something to how unassuming this movie is, too. Like, this movie isn't looking to change your life, but it's happy if it does, if that makes any sense. Like, it's not really...
I don't agree with you, but I mean, I just...
I guess what I mean is that I don't know that... I think that this film had an incredible emotional impact on me, but I'm not convinced that Don McKellar...
it's a magnum opus. Like,
I mean, but it's his first movie.
So? Fucking Citizen Kane was Orson Welles' first movie.
I guess that's true.
It's a magnum opus. Like it's a like the end of if you watch the end of that film and yeah. you don't think he was trying to change your life, I don't get it.
Like, I guess that's true. I guess that's true. I can't dispute that. I guess I just mean that it's not it doesn't feel it just feels so intimate.
Yeah.
In a way, it's not, it doesn't feel like this sprawling giant thing. And I guess that's my own fault for equating that as important and non-important or as epic and not epic. It is epic in its intimacy, I guess.
I think that's the brilliance of the movie for me is how affecting it was without, without being Lawrence of Arabia.
Sure.
You know, or, you know, we just watched the trailer for the Eternals and it had one of those very typical, you know, sure. like pans giant over
sweeping,
water.
Yeah.
Giant sweeping pan over water in the beginning, which kind of, you know, says it's going to be a really important, beautiful movie. It does none of that. It's a pretty ugly looking movie, but that's fine. That's again, the way it kind of lulls you into a sense of, I watched this in two sittings. Like I did. I mean, I started late on Saturday night, but like, it wasn't it wasn't urgent for me.
Sure.
And I think that that is kind of like the second half is just such a wallop.
It's amazing. I'm going to give a little bit of context, Chandler, unless you had something you wanted to, did you want to say before I do the context?
Oh, I mean, I just think that, you know, especially in the context of this movie, I know when Armageddon was being released, Don McKellar was afraid that like, oh, people aren't going to watch this movie if they're watching Armageddon.
Right. And they didn't.
But I don't know if it's because of Armageddon, but yeah.
It's really like, it's a small scale, like human story that's like been expertly like drama. The dramaturgy of this movie is incredible. Like you feel like Don McKellar is just such a great writer and it's so nuanced and specific. And it's so Canadian in that, of course, people would spend their last day on earth, like being guilty that they haven't called their mother back or, you know, like David Cronenberg plays like a man whose last day on earth is spent like politely.
Yes.
She like stays on the streetcar, like being like, "Oh, I'm sure the driver will come back soon." It's like, that is like, I've lived in Toronto I was born here. I've lived here like almost my whole life. And it's just like the kind of level of like politeness and passive aggression and toxicity and like someone like asking you to have sex with them on the last night of your earth and you being, "Oh, I would consider it if I had time to emotionally prepare for it. But unfortunately, I must go back home." It's like, that's what being Canadian is.
What I really appreciate about this movie, beyond all the stuff I said, beyond Don McKellar's, you know, kind of journey that mirrors my own in life, it also had a very healthy global relationship, with death and with the end of the world. And I kept thinking, well, okay, you have Cronenberg's character who's calling every single customer of the gas company and saying, "We're going to do our best to keep the gas on." You have the other woman who works there who's also working. You have the people who are still working for the news. You have people and people who are, you know, having sex with strangers. And every moment you do have this little voice in the back of your head saying, "Is that really what they would do on their last night on Earth?" And you know what? I feel really strongly that like, you got to do something, and you got to do something. And what are you going to do? Are you going to go kill someone? I mean, like some characters do, or are you going to flip cars over like some characters do? Are you going to have sex with strangers like some characters do? Some people are just happy to go about their routine. And I've gotten to the point in my life where if the world was ending tomorrow night, I wouldn't do anything special. I would just go about it like any other day. Not because of any psychological thing where I'm like, this is the healthiest thing to do. You're dying anyway. It doesn't matter. Just, you got to do something. And I think about that in terms of, again, you know, this movie, this very small, intimate movie makes you think about very large things and themes in your life and consequences of living and having a life and having ambitions. And I think about people like Clint Eastwood or Sidney Lumet. Or whatever, any director who works into their 80s or 90s, or anybody who works into their 80s or 90s. Why do they do that? Why would you get up when you're 85 years old and go make, you got to do something? Like, what are you going to do? Sit and fucking drink lemonade? You got to do something. You're alive. So you may as well make the most of it. And if you like making films, you should make films. And that's how I feel about this movie. Okay, you have one day left. Well, do something you like doing. Yeah. You know, but so
it keeps you alive too, right? Like it keeps you motivated, keeps your mind occupied.
I'm not confident of that. I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that like you just gotta do something, or else you're doing nothing and you're worrying.
And well, that's like, what Billy Wilder complained about the most was when he basically couldn't get a movie made for like almost the last 20 years of his life. And it drove him crazy. He was just like, I just want to be making movies. And it couldn't happen. Chandler, you were going to say something?
Oh, I think what struck me about this movie, watching it again, was that it kind of feels like, it's almost like he took the conceit of like New Year's Eve, you know, and like the pressure of New Year's Eve and what are you going to do on New Year's Eve? And you have this idea that there's this big countdown and like, you're heading into the new year and you have to mark it in a special way. But like every time you try to do that, you're still bringing all of your own insecurities and ego. And it's always depressing to know that New Year's Eve is sometimes depressing for people. And it never occurred to me that on the last night of my life, I would feel like, I'm sure my mom would organize something and I would be conflicted whether or not I want to stay there. And she'd be like pressuring me into being there all night. And I'd be like, I think I have to go. Oh, you're just going home to your apartment alone. And like, you know, like this idea that like, it's actually a lot of pressure to think about how you would spend the last night. And if I'm just thinking about if this movie came out now and got remade and sort of also the context of watching it during a pandemic, like in Toronto, having experienced like everything we have this year, it's kind of like fascinating to think about how social media would absolutely ruin this. This movie would not be the same if it was made today.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, you're right. And I think one of the most liberating things I've done in my life is not caring about New Year's Eve anymore. I don't stay up till midnight, not on purpose. I just never stay up till midnight, you know? And I just, it's like any other fucking night, which is just what it is. Like I used to, I mean, the worst night of my life was New Year's Eve 2000. And New Year's Eve 2000 for me, I was a senior in high school. I had a lot of friends and I felt really good about like my place and school and how we were going to have this great New Year's. This was a great party. I believe it was Kristen Quintano's house. Our whole grade was there and several other grades. And it really was like, it had a real like, you know, devil's night feel, but the opposite. We're like, nothing bad was going to happen, but everything was off. Everything was on limits, right? Okay. So I wound up getting really sick that week. And I wound up getting on and having to be on antibiotics. And this was definitely before I was like the kind of person who would drink on antibiotics. I didn't know what was going to happen. So I wasn't going to drink on New Year's Eve, which, you know, like sucked, but also meant I was going to drive my friends, which wasn't terrible.
Okay.
What that meant was I had the car, right?
Sure.
I was, and I, not only that, I had a car, I was sober. So around, and again, you know, just like this countdown of this movie where you see 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. Around 10 o'clock, one of my best friends, whose name also was Kenny, said, the only other Kenny I've ever known, said that his girlfriend who lived two towns over was having an issue with an ex-boyfriend. And he needed to go pick her up. And the issue was like, I don't really know what it is, but it sounded dangerous.
Okay.
So he said he couldn't because he was too drunk and he asked me to take his car and go. So I took his car and drove to town, drove like 30 minutes there, 30 minutes back at 10 o'clock on New Year's Eve 2000. You know, with all my big plans for the night, but they were blown. And on top of that, I remember his interior light wouldn't go off. So the windows were all fogged up. So I was constantly like unfogging the windows. I didn't know how to use his car. I got there like kind of prepared to like potentially have to fight someone. Mm-hmm. We got in. Kenny was, you know, bigger and stronger than me and was kind of able to like scare the guy off and then stayed with his girlfriend there. So I am driving back across town in his shitty car. To like two towns, another half hour, show up at 11 o'clock. Kristen lived on top of a hill. I was parked, my car was parked on top of the hill. His car, I had to park down at the bottom because it was late. So I parked his car down at the bottom around 11:15, go up, had a devastating crush on this girl who I was hoping to like kiss that night. Walked up the hill, only to find this girl and another one of my best friends making out on my car. And then I stood outside, didn't even watch the ball drop on New Year's Eve 2000 with my good friend, Jeremy Tucker. And we just stood there and that was it.
On your car, insult to injury. On my car.
Yes. And I'm sure they didn't know it was my car. And I'm sure they didn't know that I had this, you know,
crush. Yeah.
The suffocating crush. But it was, point being, it was a bad New Year's Eve. When they were driving across like the world in their car at like 11 o'clock, it reminded me of that. And it's not worth trying to ever make these things that should be totally spontaneous, like exceptional. It's not worth it. It's just worth like living in the moment and having things happen. mm-hmm. doing your best to have a good time. But if they don't, being able to, like, you know, pivot into something else that's something else new and fun and exciting. So that's it. That was my shitty New Year's Eve. And I think that also informed my like feelings about this movie and my feelings sure. about trying to like make something as good as possible, like as good as, you know, just be yourself. Just it's any other night. So
I want to give it just a little bit of context.
Story, but that was,
please. Yeah. Listen, in this Canadian drama by Don McKellar, various citizens of Toronto anxiously await the end of the world, which is occurring for reasons unexplained at midnight. While widower Patrick Wheeler, played by Don McKellar, braces for his fate, he meets Sandra, played by Sandra Oh, the wife of a businessman who's intent on committing suicide. Meanwhile, Patrick's friend Greg, played by Callum Keith Rennie, embraces a hedonistic approach to the apocalypse, decides to have as much sex as he can while there's still time. Last Night opened in the United States on April 30th, 1999. It would go on to make around $600,000 on a $2.3 million budget. It's got 84% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 85% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars and says, I'm writing in the closing days of December 1999. There are those who expect an apocalypse in a week or so when Y2K shuts down the power grid and roving bands of carnivorous Americans stalk heavily armed into the streets to steal each other's Christmas presents. My own guess is that New Year's Eve will be more uneventful than usual as most of us pause awestruck at the chiming of the millennial clock. Don McKellar's Last Night is a Canadian film about the end of the world and paints a picture more bittersweet than violent. While American fantasies run towards riot, rape, and pillage, life will end in Toronto, we learn, with farewell dinners, favorite songs, and people deciding they have put off far too long their intention to sleep with one another.
And people taking golf clubs to cars.
Correct.
And Sandra Oh barely getting away from getting like attacked by a mob. Like, I love you Canadians, but like, let's not pretend that that wasn't also part of the movie.
Roger Ebert's the one that made this a
I know, culture I war. Know. You're right. But like, I think that if it didn't have those elements, people would be like, you Canadians live on another planet.
Correct. The New York Times.
For Columbine, where Michael Moore goes and unlocks everybody's door from Toronto.
Yes.
And, like, walks in people's houses and they're
it's
like,
ridiculous.
It's like, oh.
No one locks their doors. Yeah. I mean, anyway. The New York Times said a smart, stiff upper lip alternative to a movie like Armageddon. Don McKellar and Sandra Oh give intense performances. Entertainment Weekly gave the film an A-, calling it a surreal, elegantly melancholy, and yet witty ensemble story, and that Sandra Oh stole all of the scenes. Peter Howell of the Toronto Star commented on the many Canadian cast members, suggesting that the film might be too damn Canuck for its own good. Yeah. In 2002, readers of Playback Magazine
voted Insecure Canadian. He doesn't eat it. Own it, man.
Yeah.
In 2002, readers of Playback Magazine voted Last Night as the 9th greatest film of all time. Canadian film of all time. And in 2012, Oliver Littleton of IndieWire named the film one of the 5 most underseen apocalypse films worthy of viewing, writing that compared to Armageddon and Deep Impact for its quiet, character-driven approach.
It's nothing like those movies. It's just that they don't... Well, I mean, it's like Deep Impact, but it's not like Armageddon. Armageddon is not about the end of the world. Armageddon is about saving the world. Like it's a completely different film. It is about actively trying to stave off the end of the world. Deep Impact, like to some extent, is about trying to save it and failing. And then the last act kind of becomes like the last 10 minutes becomes trying to accept it. This movie is about acceptance from the jump. It's like it's so lazy to even put it in the context of those films.
But I was watching this. I watched this film on CBC Gem, which is the CBC's like streaming service. So every 20 minutes it would break for ads and it'd be like, take the Canadian census today. Or like, Ontario's got you covered for your Corona shot vaccine. Now Canadians must take the vaccine. Oh, we've got this, Ontario. Do your part.
That's amazing. But so was it in Letterboxd on Gem,
yeah,
or was it also in 4.5?
Weird format. So
that's weird.
That's cool. I didn't know that. I love.
Yeah, it's in 4.5. It seems. I mean, I guess it was shot on film, but it looks video at times.
It does. It looks
shot on film. I think they did a bleach bypass for the color correction, which is very of the era. Like that's what like 3K.
Yeah. It's just, it's an odd looking movie. I forgot that about it. And when it started, I think similar to you, Kenny, I found it a little bit like, ugh, this movie really kind of doesn't look great. But then was pulled into the story and stopped caring. But I definitely felt like it has a very intentional, as you mentioned, Chandler, the bypass component of it.
It's probably to emulate like the light, like
yeah,
brighter, right, and more stark.
And
but
blown
I think
out.
I also yeah. read that he, you know, intentionally tried to like film it in a more composed way because he was afraid about like acting and directing at the same time. So
sure.
He kind of wanted to have more like long takes and stuff.
Which you definitely feel like it's a pretty static movie. There's not a lot of camera movement in it. Although there are some nice moments, and there's some photography moments that when we walked through the plot that jumped out at me. But I wanted to sort of, you know, Chandler, you just wrapped shooting a feature in Toronto during a pandemic.
Yeah.
So it does feel like, you know, did you think about, I mean, I don't know how many exteriors you had. This is a pretty exterior heavy movie, all things considered, which Kenny mentioned in terms of why perhaps the budget was a little bit higher. But were there a lot of exteriors in your film? Did you think about your film while you were watching this film at all?
My film's like almost exclusively interiors.
So right. Okay. Really, there you go.
I can't quite, it's not comparable, but I do think that there, it's interesting because I was thinking a lot kind of about, like, I feel like everything you need to know about Canadian cinema is sort of wrapped up in that little recap that you did of like the reception of last night. It's kind of like a Canadian critic decrying that the movie's too Canadian and won't be successful because of that. Roger Ebert saying like, oh, this movie is so polite, even though there's like a huge amount of violence and David Cronenberg like literally gets shot in the face.
Shot in the face.
Yeah.
It made $600,000. yet it played at like Cannes and, you know, like, yep. Like last night is like always frequently like one of the, it's like in the Canadian registry domain is like, what, like our biggest cinematic accomplishment?
What? Well, it is, but that's great because it's the best film ever made. But what?
Like this is like the gold standard of Canadian cinema, this movie, and it's so funny that you're like, oh, I don't know, I've never heard of this before, but like for us, it's like this is what we're known for. This is as good as it gets when it comes to.
That's I don't know whose fault that is. I don't blame myself. but I am curious. My interest was piqued when they said it was considered the ninth greatest film of all time. If you told me an American film was the ninth greatest film of all time, I could probably rattle off what the top eight were within like. Well, I could probably tell you what I think. Like a
yeah,
group
you'd be
of
like
people,
Casablanca, Citizen.
In like 15 guesses, I can nail.
Yeah.
So what are I'm just assuming you guys can do the same for Canadian films, even though you obviously can do it for American films as well. What are considered like the top 10 Canadian films of all time?
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's actually a harder question than you would think. I mean, I don't
clearly
say that.
Chandler immediately was like, Casablanca. Yes, it is very easy for American films. What is it for? It's
like,
got to be.
It's probably like Going Down the Road and Stories We Tell might squeeze on.
I would put that up there. I mean, Sweet Hereafter definitely would.
Sarah Polley's story, Stories We Tell?
Yeah.
So like recent stuff, Sweet Hereafter is pretty recent.
Like Archie Najuwet, The Fast Runner would probably be on that.
Sure. I think, I mean, also just, I mean, there would be some Cronenberg. I imagine you'd have a Dead Ringers or a Videodrome or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, goodness. I think
I can't wait for you to do the Screen Trash Canadian films.
I'm excited. No,
but
I'm excited.
I'm going to talk to Clay first and make it very clear that they should be films that were shot by Canadians in Canada.
Yeah.
Because I do think that, like,
sure.
I think that that's.
I think Denis Villeneuve's Maelstrom is a wonderful movie. That would be on my list for sure. I mean,
I'm going to look it up.
Sorry, Kenny. I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you saying?
No, I think that they should be Canadian films shot in Canada.
The top 10 Canadian films of all time are, according to the... Oh, no, I think TIFF did eventually do the actual all-time best.
Yeah, TIFF, what do you got?
Okay, this according to the Canadian Encyclopedia.
Okay.
Okay, this is from Tiff. Wait.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I think this is right. Okay, number one, Artanajua, the fast runner. Shout out. Hi, Zachary.
To yourself. Shout out to yourself.
Shout out to me. I knew it. 2002. So the greatest movie of ever made in Canada came out in 2002.
Wow. It's like In the Mood for Love.
Antoine, 1971. Claude Jutra, canceled. Filmmaking.
Wait, hang on one second. The first two films, are they both French language?
No, the first one is an indigenous film, so it's entirely...
okay.
And then the second one is French language from
Quebec. Oy, oy, oy. Come on, guys.
Not there's anything wrong with that, but this country is like 80 or 90% English speaking, right? So, like, come on. Stop being so self-hating. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it just points to kind of English Canadian cinema, how it's thought of in Canada. Number three, Gadda Nagoyan, Sweet Hereafter, 1997. Number four, Jesus of de Montreal, Denis Arcand, 1989. A lot of these are like from the late 80s and 90s. Lielo, 1988.
What a country.
David Cronenberg. Crazy by Jean-Marc Vallée is number eight.
Interesting. That's a recent movie.
Yeah. My Winnipeg.
My Winnipeg was a doc, right?
Pardon?
Yeah. No.
My Winnipeg is a doc? Or it's not a doc?
Oh, it is. It's kind of like a surrealist, abstract kind of documentary. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then number 10 is a tie between Stories We Tell, Sarah Polley, and Les Ordres by Michel Brault in 1974.
I think it's interesting, and it's worth highlighting the large French-Canadian component of this list. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that I actually think that a fair amount of Canadian films that transcend outside of Canada tend to be French-Canadian because they feel like they have more...
Foreign films.
Yeah, they're foreign and what happened. I mean, this is part of... There's a cachet, but I also, Chandler, I want to ask you about this too, because I feel like, and Kenny, I want your thoughts on this as well. There is every time, every media class I had in high school and in junior high, there would inevitably be a teacher that would say, this is the definition of Canadian cinema, or this is the definition of Canadian music in comparison to American music or American film. And, you know, part of the problem is that we don't have the most definable traits in terms of cinema, right? Like, and I think that that's why the films tend not to transcend. We speak English, so there isn't another, you know, there isn't a it doesn't sound British, it doesn't sound Australian. Well, it doesn't, you know, there's yeah, sorry, go ahead.
You guys speak English, right? And I think that it's you guys speak English as your first language. You speak English with, you know, no accent or no discernible accent.
Do I have Canadian more accent? Can you hear it?
No, I have more of an accent than you do. You guys have more of a neutral accent than my heavy New York accent. But I think it's interesting that at least half of those films were either French language or Inuit language. I think you First Nations language. That you Canadian filmmakers are already at a detriment within your own country. There is a bias against English speaking Canadian artists within your own country. That's fucking crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of for a long time English Canadian cinema was considered bad. For all the reasons that you brought up, like this kind of idea that it's a low budget, the films don't look expensive, they don't seem like they're filmed like with any kind of Spielbergian gloss that like American audiences are used to. You don't recognize the actors, we don't have a Canadian star system, so you can't be like, oh wow, Callum Keith Rennie's in this movie, I've got to watch that.
I love Canada.
I mean, there are some big Callum Keith Rennie fans.
I love Canada. I think this is the dumbest thing in the world. I think this is like, it's so upsetting. It's actually like weirdly upsetting to me that like...
We all we feel so insecure. We're like, oh, you watched our little movie. Thank you so much. I don't know.
Yeah, I went to the... I, I went to the Olympics in Calgary. No, not Calgary. In Vancouver.
Vancouver. 2000 and what year was that?
It was 2000 and
was it 12? 2012?
It was like 12. I mean, I went with Laura, so it had to be like 2010, something like that.
Chandler and I were actually just talking about how even in Canadian circles, I mean, she just read a list of the top 10 quote unquote greatest Canadian films, and this film doesn't even register on that, which I find baffling.
I think the list gets updated every once in a while, and then things drop off.
But still, it's one of those films that I feel like it seems to have somehow fallen between the cracks, and it's not that bad.
Yes, but ten is small. Like if you did it, now granted, Canada doesn't have the
depth,
breadth that America has in terms of 800 films a year now. But you do a top 10 of American films, maybe Schindler's List checks in. Maybe like we're talking
of recent movies. Yeah.
I'm talking of the last. I'm talking since like 1980.
Yeah. Yep.
Like I maybe Schindler's List makes that list. Maybe There Will Be Blood makes that list. And I'm just talking about like so it's not super crazy to me that a fairly recent film didn't make it. However,
yeah,
it seems like five of those films are within the last 25 years.
Correct.
So.
Yeah, I want to just take a sec to talk about Cronenberg, who obviously is an enormous Canadian filmmaker in his own right and has acted periodically from time to time. I love David Cronenberg's acting.
Me too.
Fantastic.
He's such a great actor.
He's a great actor, but there's also something there's something very genuine and heartfelt about him, but he's also such an inherently creepy human. So like there's this dissonance going on of like he's a sweet guy and he's calling all of these people to say the gas company will continue to run for, whatever. But because he sounds like a serial killer on some level, you're just sort of like, there's this push and pull with him that I really love. And sometimes he leans into it, to comedic effect with To Die For, where he plays the person that, spoiler, ultimately murders Nicole Kidman at the end of To Die For, or in Alias, where he appears as a kooky scientist, where he kind of leans into the persona of David Cronenberg. This is a really tender performance in this movie. What did you guys think of it?
It's such a specific, like, idiosyncratic character, and it's such a nice reveal that that's who Sandra Oh's husband is. He's kind of like David Lynch. Like, he's just so singular, and, like, whoever he is as a performer, like, he just evokes his own universe, so. Mm-hmm. And here it really, really works.
Or even we had Werner Herzog in Julian Donkey Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Who's unbelievable in this
film. He's so good.
So unlike himself and so brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's really interesting when, directors don't act that often unless they are actor, writer, directors, or what have you. So when they do, obviously people take notice. But when they're really good actors, like I think Martin Scorsese is a great actor.
I wish that he acted more.
His
incredible.
Yeah, he's great.
It's such a blessing. Not a blessing for us. It's a blessing of another filmmaker for a director to appear in their movie. I think Werner Herzog being in a Harmony Korine film speaks volumes about what he thinks about Harmony Korine. Just like this, I think really says a lot about what Cronenberg thinks about Don McKellar. The dawn of Canadian filmmaking kind of blessing him this way. And you see it, over and over and over again. It's a very cool thing.
It is cool.
Yeah, I love it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think it's tremendous. And I even think, you know, the scene that Cronenberg has when the guy walks into his house with the shotgun and...
Oh, it's so good.
It's so good because, I mean, first of all, Cronenberg is great in it, but even just what he's saying, like, I'm not scared of you. Like, I don't know what you think you're going to accomplish with this.
You're the one who is scared.
Yeah.
You're the one who is scared. But that last one with just silhouettes, stop it. Like, you don't think this is a beautiful movie? Like,
Yeah.
Just kicks the shit out of you.
It's great. So I want to talk about Sandra Oh, who is tremendous in this movie. One of her earlier films in sort of, you know, in terms of size of role, she had a couple things before this. She is tremendous in this movie. I would say that the one thing that we don't see much of in this performance is her tremendous comedic timing and her, I mean, like, she's an unbelievably funny actress. This isn't a particularly funny role, but she's really, really wonderful in it. Chandler, what did you think of Sandra's performance in this?
Oh yeah, I mean, also incredible. Like, at that time, I feel like most movies wouldn't have cast like an Asian woman in this part, you know?
Correct.
And I don't know if that's like obviously Sandra Oh is just like incredible. And if you have a chance to cast Sandra Oh in anything, cast her like immediately. She's extraordinary. But I think probably for audiences, it's probably one of the first times that you've seen like an Asian leading lady in like a very, in like a, you know, romantic leading role. Like, before that, she was more doing small movies with like Mina Shamm. I think that was one of her first parts. But like the maturity that she brings to this performance and like some of the line deliveries that she has, when she's at Don McKellar, like, is like, yeah, okay, you know what, I thought about it. I don't want to sleep with you, but like, you can stay the night. You can have your life. No, she's like, no, I want you to shoot me. And her incredible delivery of that line. I mean, it's just like she has to do something that's so hard and she just anchors it with so much commitment and emotionality. And like that last scene is powerful because of her. It's like the tears that are coming out of her eyes. It's like the connection that she's
amazing. Making
with her scene partner. It's like she elevates Don McKellar there 100%.
Oh my God. Yeah. Also, she does a couple things. I mean, it's written, but it could have been just a disaster.
Absolutely.
Make Me Love You. I Want to Love You.
I know.
Disaster, almost always, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. No, and it's so, so powerful. And it's like the first time I watched the movie, that's what made the hugest impression on me. It still does.
And then how about not saying, like, you know, when the clock strikes zero, one, we shoot each other. You'll know. And it doesn't telegraph the moment. I really did think they were going to shoot each other or we were going to cut to, you know, black or whatever before they did. Or one, you know, Sopranos-ish. But you'll know. I don't know, man. It's the fucking boldest. Like, I think, like, we on this podcast, we sometimes are very nitpicky because we don't like films and we're looking for reasons why we like it, like the kind of bulletproof explanations for why we don't like it. And I do have some nitpicky things in this movie, but they all just washed away by the end. Right.
I'm curious what your nitpicky things are.
Well, so here's the thing. I watched it again. As I said, I watched it in two sittings. So I thought a lot in between the two sittings about the film. And I was really tantalized by the scene where Sandra Oh goes to get the wine, comes back with the wine. Her car has been put vertically somehow Yeah. And she opens the door and gets out the briefcase. We don't know what the briefcase is. Mm-hmm. And that scene is so cool and evocative and fun and weird that I started thinking, like, I want more of it.
Like, that it is. Like, is the yes. most cinematic the movie gets, other than the overturned streetcar, which is incredible.
Computer generated. Yeah.
So I start thinking, so, you know, you leave halfway through and that moment never leaves you and it never will leave you. And it's the kind of thing that should be on, you know, one perfect shot fucking memes totally. for the rest of existence. Mm-hmm. But I did think, like, that's what I think I want out of this movie. Out of a Canadian, you know, apocalypse drama, like, I know that my Canadians could do Quirk. Like, let's go there. So I thought I was getting more of that. But again, like, that's that nit, as I said, like, that just washes away. Now that just becomes part of the fabric. That just becomes one movement in a movie about so many different things. Like, we haven't even talked about the guy. Again, this speaks to my whole, like, you got to do something on the last night of your life. The guy who plays is like recital.
It's
gorgeous.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Phil, that's like my idea for a show. Like, this, like, thing. Like, I love that idea that, like, yeah. Are you not going to do it because the world's ending? Yeah, just take your shot. It's literally now or never.
I was thinking about that too. I was like really impressed that he had like, you know, he had like 15, 20 people there. That's
some people showed up. Yeah.
Again, like,
came after.
As soon as he started playing and he was good,
yeah.
I started thinking, this is about as lovely a way to end my life that I can think of. Like, again, so many great ways to go out. And so many, you know, you're going to go out no matter what. And so many fine ways to go out. And I'm very much not of the opinion that this is the end anyway. So what a lovely way to go out. I love piano music. I love theaters. I love like that sense of calm. And I know some people get that from opera or ballet. I get that from, like, you know, orchestral performances. And it's as good as it gets.
Well, I think it also speaks to, and, you know, we've been talking about this, you know, throughout this episode, but it's worth sort of saying again that, you know, Don McKellar sat down and said, you know, what would people do on the last night of their lives, as far as he's concerned? And all of these are incredibly emotional, intimate, human things that are happening. Like, there, which speaks to this film just understanding that the small things in life are the things that are, to quote Vanilla Sky, they're the biggest. Like, that the little things are the things that really get us through, right? It's not about some grandiose craziness. It's about what's, you know, it's about human connection. And I think this movie beautifully does that and speaks to sort of, sorry, can I go ahead?
No, at the risk of sounding like a contrarian asshole. Okay. Little things and big things are equal. There's no such thing as a little thing or a big thing, right? They're all equal. So, you know, planning for or trying to achieve some quote unquote big moment has no more profundity than sitting and being an observer for a piano concert. Yeah. I think the saddest character in the whole film, even sadder than the mom who is feeling something and feeling something's really good, even if it's feeling like betrayal or remorse or regret or whatever, was Sarah Polley.
Yeah.
Sarah Paul, she tried to make a moment of it. And like, oh, what a nightmare.
I mean, well, I love Sarah Pauly, obviously. Her
boyfriend is like a cold-blooded killer and just wants to murder people, essentially. He takes like really too much pleasure in like hitting that person in the head with a shovel.
Correct.
And like, she's like, let's go to like
the party.
I swear, it's going to be so fun. And it's like, you know that she just got back together with that guy like 2 months ago. And like,
the world's ending, may as well give it a shot.
There are a couple Canadian things that did make me laugh just in sort of, I mean, first of all, the reference to Mel Lastman Square did make me go, like, the last place I'm going to be on the last moments of the world are Mel Lastman Square, which is for Kenny, it's an area of Toronto, obviously.
Is that where people go on New Year's?
They have like a big party and usually like that's where like Snow would play a free concert on
Everyone's favorite Canadian artist, Snow, would play.
Wait, is that like Informer?
Yes.
Oh, okay, cool. totally valid. Go ahead.
But the other thing was the taking care of business. Wasn't that the song?
I love that part. Yes. They would all be learning that there was the dream of
the biggest jam session in the history of the world.
Yeah, that was so great.
Randy Bachman
playing with taking care of business.
Turner Overdrive Canadian?
It's incredible. Yeah, yes. I think so. Yeah.
It's
even funnier if they weren't, but that's hilarious.
Yeah, Randy Bachman was in the Guess Who.
It's great. But yeah, so there's just very sort of niche
taking care of business.
It's amazing.
I love the anchor's like, it's a great song. The anchor with the empty newsroom behind him. My one true hero of this film, the guy like who's on the air at midnight as the world's ending, a great song.
Yeah, and thanking his buddy for like keeping the camera rolling.
Yeah,
but that's the thing, you do need those people. Like, I was thinking about this too. I was like, there would be Uber drivers on The Last Night in the World
for sure.
There would be like people, you know, selling you novelty ice creams, and people would be in a line like waiting for some kind of fancy. Like society, like, I guess that's what I was thinking when I was watching this. It's like, because it's the last night of the world, like people are still thinking probably about their relationships to capitalism and stuff. People are probably still working. People are still trying to make money. The streetcar probably would be driving, you know?
Yeah. I think that capitalism would melt away in the end. I don't think there's anything to win at that point, right? I think if money, you know, if you can't spend the money tomorrow, like that. When I thought the woman at the beginning who sleeps with Callum, whatever his name is, when I thought she was a sex worker, that struck me as, I don't believe this because there's no money, there's no place to spend the money. But ultimately, she wasn't. Or at least there wasn't any money exchange. I don't actually know what the situation was. I do think people would be like giving away their ice cream. I do think people would be driving their Ubers as a public service. I think that the gas would still be on. I think that there are a lot of people who would see it as a responsibility to humanity to keep, you know, to keep, quote unquote, keep the trains moving. But I don't think there would be money exchange.
But if I may, I mean, I think this pandemic has kind of showed that that's the opposite case, really. And
I think there's a tomorrow in this one. I think everyone always thought there would be tomorrow.
Potentially, but I don't know. I mean, it's like, look how much of different social systems it's tried to erode, and like capitalism has like always won, and how many people have been taken out of their homes, and how many people have lost their jobs, and how the pandemic has really failed essential workers, and so many people that it's sacrificed. It's at the
I think as long as the earth is continuing, capitalism will win the day. And not always. This is a much bigger topic, but in a capitalist society, until there's, you know, real structural change, I think it's gonna always kind of, you know,
money talks and bullshit walks.
I think it's easier to oppress in a situation like this. I think it's easier to take advantage of people in a situation like this. And I think that people at the top had a real good feeling, borne out by statistics and access, that they were going to survive this, and that it was worth, calling in all their markers when people were at their most vulnerable.
Which is gross and terrible.
Well, which is what wound up happening. It wasn't, but I would also say it wasn't what was happening in the beginning. In the beginning, debts were being excused. In the beginning, rent was being,
correct,
ignored, and people were having just a little more grace.
Yeah.
Well, they're just having grace. There is a certain level of grace for a little bit. But.
Sure. I want to talk about the Callum Keith Rennie character for a second, because it's sort of the last one that we haven't really talked about. You know, I think it's a great performance, and I think what this film does pretty well is actually hide the ball on a bunch of characters. So we're a little unsure as to what's transpiring until, you know, the reveals, which I think is quite well done. I didn't remember Callum Keith Rennie's reveal, if you will. So I was sort of like, this guy just okay, I guess he's just going to have sex a bunch because that's just whatever.
You didn't remember the room of sexual positions?
I didn't remember the kitchen scrawled with different ways of having sex with people. And
that haunted me when I first saw it in high school. I was like,
oh, I'm sure. You're like, does every guy do this? but I do think that
yeah, we do. That was dead on.
This is the most important movie you've ever seen.
Yes, mine is in a kitchen. Mine is in a kitchen. Mine is a word doc. But
sure. I think it's interesting.
I'm kidding deeply.
Well, you never know.
I actually think that's
the whole point of this character. That it's not obvious that guys aren't like that. I think the whole point of this character is that there's an expectation that a lot of guys are like that. So I think that that's, you know, kind of at least to me where a lot of the relevance of this character comes from.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think that, you know, it's a character that I would say that of all the characters in this film, this is the one that I think would probably be the worst if the movie was made today. Like, I think it'd be just the most bro-y, the most sort of like, this character could have been executed really poorly. And I think that there is the scene he has with Don McKellar is a phenomenal scene.
It's a great scene. Yeah.
It's a great scene because it, at least to me, sort of, it gave some depth to a character that could have just been seen as like a dude that just, you know, wanted to have lots of sex before the world was over. But instead, like, it's kind of his love language. Like that, you know what I mean? Like that it's sort of his way of trying to kind of
his coping mechanism.
His coping mechanism. Yeah, exactly. It's his way of articulating his feelings for Don McKellar and the past that they've had. And sorry, go ahead, Chandler.
Oh, and just, I think just like having some kind of physical connection and like source of intimacy if you don't have anybody to love. And I mean, what he's doing, like that first scene where he's like negotiating with this woman at a party and he's saying that like he met her and he wanted to like sleep with her, she's so attractive, but really it's because he's never had sex with a black woman before. And you know, and she's being fetishized and like tokenized, and it's really really wrong. But then also she's like, I just want to have an orgasm today.
Yeah. And I mean, and then when he he brings his old French teacher to his house, Madame Carlton.
And fitting to like fill, you know, Canadian language requirements, there's also some awkward speaking in French. Canadian language requirements. But it, I mean, beaucoup de dessins dans le architecture.
It's a great scene. The first scene with Craig and her, where we sort of suss out their relationship as she talks about, you know,
what a
good man he's grown into. And it's just the whole, it's great. It's great.
All those scenes are so well written, and you're right. They could be like totally in the hands of a lesser, like more, less sensitive, less acutely understanding writer. Like I think they could, and director, cause like you can write something, but then the direction can totally take it to the wrong place. They're so perfectly calibrated. And especially I want to say like the last scene with Tracy Wright, who's Don McKellar's like longtime partner and an incredible actor. Like she's one of my favorite actors of all time. And she's so good in so many Canadian movies, but also she has like the most incredible performance in Me, You, and Everyone You Know.
She's so good in that. The last scene with the little boy.
On the bench. She's just miraculous. And they had such a powerful relationship together. And I just love Tracy Wright so much. And she'll always be like my favorite Canadian actress. And it's so sad that she died of cancer.
Yeah.
She's just wonderful.
She's tremendous in this. And she's, I guess, the last woman that he has sex with. And she's a virgin. And I want to just rewind real quick to the Madame Carlton scene. I love when she says bon voyage before the doors close, which is,
again, fantastic. A masterful delivery of that line. Like, again, that could be like He just, yes. You know, they're very tricky scenes. I'm really in awe of him as a director of how he managed to like nail the tone and sort of the, what you're saying, this kind of bittersweet line between comedy and drama, but it's also an apocalypse movie, but it's so grounded.
It's this is maybe of any film that we've covered so far, this is the type of film, Kenny, that this script, if given to somebody else, I'm pretty much convinced wouldn't work. Like, I don't know that you could, like, to Chandler's, the calibration that Don McKellar is finding, because I think that so many lines, so many scenes in this movie could have fallen flat, could have been treacly, could have been shitty. Anyway,
And for your first feature, like, that amount of pressure, and that's 2.5 million Canadian dollars. No one gets budgets like that in Canada. You're basically making a blockbuster.
Have you guys seen, I think it's called Searching for a Friend for the End of the World?
Yes.
Oh, I was thinking about that in this context. It's the same woman who made Hustlers, right?
Yeah, Lorraine Scafaria.
So, that movie stinks. And
I don't like that movie.
I haven't seen it.
And part of the reason it stinks, certainly in contrast to this, though I love the, you know, I heard about this film and I'm talking about last night, and I love the concept of end of the world movies that aren't about somehow staving off the end of the world. Yeah. Totally down with a good, like, let's, you know, save the world. But I'm also down with, you know, those, you know, terrestrial stories about the, you know, 7 billion other of us who aren't capable of saving the world and how we would deal with that.
Sure.
So Searching for a Friend for the End of the World is it's an overt romance. Now, it's obvious from the moment this movie starts that that's what they're going for. This film last night, to me, I did not expect these two to fall for each other. And speaking of, Phil, you'd mentioned earlier about hiding the ball on a lot of the characters, hiding the ball in that story is part of what's so powerful here. It's part of what, there is no internal stress that you're feeling during a romantic comedy, particularly one with like Keira Knightley and fucking Steve Carell, where you worry about what this moment and are they going to kiss and how is this going to feel and is this going to work? That's not what happened during this movie. It was so natural and organic and beautiful and lovely that's why I think this film works where other films like it fail. I think, I think that's...
I absolutely agree. I think that it's... I mean, it's just... You know, I'm eating my words a little bit from earlier when I was saying, you know, that the movie wasn't trying to change your world. I think that this movie deceptively simple, and that there is an ocean of depth to it, and so much of it has to do with little moments like what you just said, Chandler. You know, this moment of her saying "Bon voyage" is delivered so perfectly with this. With a little bit of a twinkle, but also this sort of like gallows humor and sadness, and like it's amazing the punch that he's able to pull out of things that feel very simple.
I think
like it's kind of like the actual scene is like you're a teacher, you just had sex with one of your former students. It's the last day of your life. You're not surrounded by any friends or family members. You've decided that after this, you're going to go to another student's piano recital.
I'm just going
to
say, Madame Carlton, by the way, kind of has it all figured out. She might have had the best last night.
Not convinced of that, but okay. Also,
I think of all the sex that he had, it was probably the best with Madame Carlton.
It was the sexiest.
Right?
Of course, because there's at least some connection there. But I was getting at and I lost my train, but what I was getting at was it was about the tone of the film. Mm-hmm. Most filmmakers, I think, are too shy and insecure to make a straight ahead romance. That's why we have so few straight ahead romances and so many romantic comedies, because at least with a comedy, you can take the piss out of the romance a little bit.
Totally.
And you're not so nakedly vulnerable when you're like, this is about two people falling in love, which is like a really fucking frightening story to tell. Because everyone falls in love differently, and are these two right for each other? But with the comedy, it's like taking a spoonful of sugar. Mm-hmm. I think this is where I was trying to get at. I think if you made this more of a straight ahead romance, you also would have had to, or you wouldn't have had to. I think most filmmakers would have felt the need to up the quirk factor or up the comedy or the silliness or up something that didn't make you feel so embarrassed for yourselves and the two characters watching them so nakedly and vulnerably falling in love. Because that's what it is. There's a level of embarrassment when you're watching a real deal romance, like the Before series, for instance. The Before series has to be so perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, you're embarrassed being there, right? You're embarrassed watching these characters having these conversations if it's not perfect. So I think by, again, hiding this romance, and I think this movie is the genre is romance. I think they consider this a romance. But by hiding the romance until literally the last frame, you don't have to up the quirk and the comedy, which would have murdered the rest of this movie. Totally. It would have murdered this film if every bit had to be tinged with a little bit of a little dollop of
cutesy,
stupidity.
What have you. Yeah.
Well, I heard that Edgar Wright is like huge fan of it last night, and this is actually one of his favorite movies. And that's why he asked Don McKellar to play the director in Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And now his next movie is called Last Night, isn't it? Last Night in Soho?
Stories he's telling, to be honest, but
the love story.
I think Edgar Wright is often embarrassed by the stories he's telling, and sometimes it works. Like I think Scott Pilgrim is a total fucking triumph. But sometimes I don't like a lot of his movies. I don't like the Coronet trilogy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think they're like embarrassed by the stories they're telling. And I think Baby Driver is a little embarrassed by the story it's telling too. Yeah. So,
I'm curious to see what his new one is, if for no other reason than it feels like hopefully he's doing something new and hopefully stretching his legs.
I think it's probably, sounds like it's more like a Dario Argento kind of movie.
A scary movie.
Yeah, like a real, actual, straight up horror.
I love scary movies. I think the thing I love about Scott Pilgrim is it's so sincere, and all of the bells and whistles exist only to serve that sincerity.
Totally. You know why it's so sincere? Because it's set in Toronto.
Because it's Canadian. there's a great line that Craig has, because at this point in the film, Sandra's looking for a car. Patrick goes over to Craig's and asks to borrow his car. And Craig doesn't want to and says, "I wanted to die a man with three cars."
Yeah.
It's good line. It's just, yeah, it's like, then I'm just a guy with two cars. And that's just a guy with two cars. Like, I wanted a collection. And it's not a collection unless I have three.
That is such a cool car, too. I love the line where he, like, after he propositions Don McKellar's character to have sex, and then he's like, "Just don't think I could handle having bad sex today.
It's literally like
that on my mind. Like, I know I'll be thinking about it. And so,
perhaps.
He also kind of does at the end of the movie. Right? Like, that's kind of bad sex that he has at the end of the movie.
Well, he fails and then hopefully kind of, I don't know.
Hopefully, right?
hopefully. Yeah. It's a great line that Don McKellar has, because I imagine that, like, you know, there's anxiety that comes with sex, and like, why would anybody want to bring that into their lives if they are an anxious person in that regard? This does bring me to another line that I like, that Craig and Patrick have in the kitchen, when Craig says, "If you gotta go," Patrick's like, "You might as well be coming," is the writing on the walls. We don't get to see all of it, but we see enough of it for it to make quite the impact.
Oh yeah. Like, whoa, bestiality is not on here? He's like, "No, I mean, it's gotta be things I'm into." Like,
it's like, you're into a lot of shit, dude. Like, bestiality doesn't seem that part. But yeah, it's a pretty the movie is not particularly, we've talked about, there's a couple visuals that definitely stick with you. That kitchen stays with you because of the way it's art directed. And it looks like something at a 7.
Yes. Yeah, that was a choice with the bypass and everything. It's very David Fincher kitchen.
And like, it's just, it's scrawled on the walls. He looks like it's just, it looks crazy. Like, it really is just an intense piece of art direction.
But think of how insane you were going during the pandemic. Now, think of that with the context that the world is ending and this is the
end. Oh, it's believable. Yeah. It's just, yeah. It's just a lot. Yeah, I want to just talk for a second a little bit more about the Patrick and Craig scene when Craig propositions him, because they do kiss, and it's
part a good of it kiss.
It's a good kiss. It's also just the way that Don McKellar tries to extricate himself from the kiss, and then for them they don't try to put on this like bravado of like masculinity after it either, as I imagine, again, another director might very well have tried to sort of undercut the scene with them kind of trying to be like men's men afterwards.
Well,
or
they
what
do.
Have
he
you.
Calls him like a fag.
He does, unfortunately, which is not great.
I think it would be almost the other way today, Phil, where maybe not today even. I think it would be almost the other way almost ever, where it was made a much bigger moment than it is.
Right, right.
Like the kind of the cool thing about it is it's a moment, but it's not a fucking life-changing moment.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, it's not like, what was that movie, Billy Someone's First On-Screen Kiss? It wasn't like this big, like, I've had my big gay moment. It was a very specific thing that happened at a specific moment between two people at the end of the world. And I wouldn't get too caught up in them using, you know, the F word like that. That's a real 1998, and that was certainly not like a homophobic barb at that. No, not the US thing.
No,
I want to make this clear to people who haven't watched it. But yes. That was.
I also
that was a
just
bad
like,
joke amongst friends.
Yeah, I. To underscore what you're saying, Kenny, which I agree with, and is sort of so much emblematic of the film, which is that like they don't make a big deal out of this kiss. They don't make a giant deal out of this thing. It's a nice moment between these two guys that has just a lot of subtext to it. And then I love that the scene just ends with Callum Keith Rennie just like sitting on... just kind of sitting there. Just he sits down next to, it looks like there's like a fireplace or something like that in the lobby or the foyer of his building. I like that this movie kind of holds in moments and lets you kind of sit in a moment. It doesn't, you know, it's not in a hurry to do things, which I appreciate about it as well. I would say that might be emblematic of Canadian cinema. We don't tend to be in a hurry. Our movies don't tend to be particularly kinetic. They're soft spoken to a certain degree.
I don't know. Denis Villeneuve isn't like that. There are lots of exceptions to the rule.
But well, that's interesting. I don't know. I think that Denis Villeneuve sits in scenes perhaps too long, and certainly sits in moments and silences. His movies, some might argue, are too long in general. He's not a kinetic filmmaker, is kind of what I'm getting at. There's a visual poetry to his movies, which I quite like. But
I guess it's more like there's an energy and an intensity.
Yes.
Visuals and the sound design and the way that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Prisoners and Sicario are fucking exhausting movies emotionally. Like they're putting you through the ringer for sure.
Yeah, or even Incendie or
earlier stuff. Sure. So basically, we're essentially at the end of the film. Sandra tries to find her husband, aka David Cronenberg, can't reconnect with him. Sort of, kind of crosses paths with Sarah Pauli's boyfriend at this end of the world party. Sandra decides to go back to Patrick's, and Patrick chooses to let her in, knowing that, you know, most likely they're going to be together for the end of the world, even though he's up to this point has chosen to be alone. And as you guys mentioned, there's a tremendous scene where the clock is ticking and they basically need to learn as much as they possibly can about each other before the end of the world, in the hopes of, feeling an emotional connection and feeling as though they know the person. Says, tell me something to make me love you. Yeah, you said it best, Kenny. I mean, an absolute landmine of a line. Like, most people just step on that thing and get blown up. So it's Sandra Oh is just a tremendous actor to be able to navigate a line like that and deliver it. You know,
it's also, I almost say this hesitantly because I think it kind of undercuts a lot of what I said about, you know, my feelings about this premise. It is the closest thing I think Don McKellar has to a, this is what you should do at the end of the world. You should embrace love.
Right.
Right. You should embrace love, your ability to love and being loved in return, much like, you know, Moulin Rouge.
The other greatest film ever made.
The other greatest film ever made. And, which is about the exact same thing and done in the exact opposite style.
It could not be more style.
But I don't think there's two different kinds of directors.
No. except they have the exact same feelings on life. But I think that's that. I think there's almost a clarity that washes over her in that last moment where you know, I almost wish I can go higher on my score, but I can't because I'm really, really high.
It really is one of the most romantic things I've ever seen in a movie.
It shouldn't be.
It's literally you spend the last night with a stranger you just met who tried and failed to help you get to reunite with your husband who's been murdered. Imagine if she came home and saw poor David Cronenberg that way. That would have been the worst possible way to spend. In a way, she's with the person that she's meant to be with in that moment that can, like, and what you said too about this idea that there's people that help you recognize your own capacity for love and feeling. And even if they're not the people that, you know, can give it back to you or that can really recognize it in themselves, they help you understand what love is. It's really, really a beautiful idea. And
I agree with everything everyone's saying here, but I also love that, like, right beforehand, Patrick says, let's go to the can and make last phone calls.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Where it's like, at least, like, they know, he knows how to bring it down. He knows how to bring it to a place where, and I mean, so Patrick and Sandra both sit on the roof facing each other, listening to the song Guantanamera,
which has never sounded more beautiful or poetic
in
my entire life. Like, it's such a strange choice.
Yes.
But it's so perfect.
Perfect.
It's sublime. It's utterly amazing.
Because he references it earlier, and it's a joke earlier almost, right?
Yeah.
When he's talking about it. And now it's fucking heartbreaking. Like, it's just this gorgeous thing. Like, and in the final seconds, basically both characters are overcome with emotion, simultaneously let their pistols slip away as they slowly embrace in a kiss. And it goes and it blows out to white.
It's, again, everything about this movie is perfect. The use of Guantanamera is shocking, and it's such a beautiful little filmic trick.
Yep.
Because he spends all this time, Don McKellar's character, I don't think we even named, what's his name?
Patrick,
you guys said it the whole time, I haven't. Patrick spends some time trying to figure out what he's going to listen to at the end of the world.
Yes.
But Don McKellar, the director, had already incepted you with the perfect song. Guantanamera is not fucking Stairway to Heaven, which is probably the right song, right? Like, it's not any... What's that?
It's love.
It's not anyone... Yeah. Guantanamera is not anybody's idea of the last song you want to listen to. If you weren't incepted, I don't know if you guys watch like me, dork, watch videos about mentalists and the way in which they get you to... You know, the way in which they read your thoughts, but it's all because they earlier in your conversation trick you in a way that you were going to have those thoughts. You were going to have those thoughts anyway, right? Like, because they have already incepted you with these ideas.
Like,
that's what. What's that?
Like a pickup artist.
Yes. Like, yes. That's what Don McKellar does with Guantanamera, where when he starts playing that song, you're like, oh, of course. Of course, Guantanamera. But you're like, this is just, this feels so right. You've been searching the whole movie for the perfect soundtrack. He fucking, it's so unbelievably brilliant. Like, it's so shockingly brilliant what he has done with this film. I somehow like it more than when I came in, and I called it my favorite film of all time when I started the podcast.
It is
more bulletproof than I thought.
It's one of those movies where, I mean, I've truly only seen it probably once before. And the power of this final moments is unbelievable. Like, it's the type of movie where you're barreling towards a conclusion, right? Which is that the world is going to end at the end of this film, right? So you know that that's coming. And yet you're completely unprepared for this ending.
Yes. Well, it's like death, right? I mean, we know it's coming, but we're completely unprepared for it. It takes you by surprise every single time. It's profoundly shocking, and yet you have to accept it. And while you're alive,
that's
you
true. Have
to find a way to make your life meaningful. And it's probably not going to be the things that you think that are going to give it value.
Mm-hmm. No, I couldn't have put it better myself. I wish we could play Guantanamo at the end of this episode.
Other point I would make about this is part of the reason I love Sandra Oh's Make Me Love You moment so much is because it does have a... All right, Patrick throughout most of this movie is not particularly lovable. We don't know why he's not lovable. We don't know it until the end. I'm very happy I did not read that Google description before because I didn't know he was a widower, right? And I didn't know when Sandra Oh essentially says... Did she die or run away? It's obvious. Yeah. Not to me, it wasn't obvious. I don't know. So what that moment says to me is it's a very big-hearted moment where it says you could find something to love about anybody. And if we are a little less judgmental, a little more open-minded, we ask the right questions, we allow ourselves to be generous and, you know, in spirit, generous in terms of, you know, the things about other people we find beautiful or relatable or inspiring. You know, I mean, I feel very cheesy saying stuff like this, but also I feel like this is true. We all have inspiring stories. We've all made it, you know, here. Good things have happened, bad things have happened. And the fact that, you know, she says, say something that makes me love you wasn't a challenge. It was just find the thing. You have it. You all have it. Find the thing. So I can't get over how from the moment with David Cronenberg saying you're the one who's afraid, where I was the one who was afraid that this was going to be a particular kind of movie, yeah. i.e. a bad one, right? I.e. one that says the worst about humanity and has really a really pessimistic view about the way we would act at the end of the world, to the end of the movie, it is just the most powerful thing I think I have ever seen. So there you go.
Wow.
Well, we should rate this movie on this note because I'm curious, Chandler, to hear your thoughts on what we're covering next week. I'm not sure if you've seen it before, but I'm curious. So
what is it like? Like Elmo's movie or some shit?
It's not.
There is an Elmo's film that we haven't done.
There is an Elmo's film we have.
Adventures in Elmo.
We Elmo's Adventures in
Grouchland. Elmo's Adventures in Grouchland. We, that's what we're doing, Chandler. What do you think?
We're not doing that very next week, so in 1999 when I saw this film, or 98 when I saw this film, I think I quite liked it. I think it made an impression on me, but I can't say that. I mean, I was 19, 18 or 19 years old, and I imagine that I was probably pretty snooty about it. And, you know, Canadian cinema, all of that. I think I liked it a lot. I gave it an 80 probably. I think that's what I probably liked it back then at. Watching it before this podcast, though, I was at a 90. It really hit me hard. And now talking about it, I'm at a 95. Like, I think it's, I really do think it's it did everything that a movie's supposed to do. It made me sort of reevaluate the human condition. It made me think about the world that we live in right now. It made me obviously think about the pandemic. It made me think about home. It made me homesick. Like, yeah, it just really, really worked for me. I really loved it. What about you, Kenny? I know you...
We didn't even discuss the pandemic that much, like barely. And you know, obviously it has newfound resonance.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in those, like when the pandemic first started in Toronto, I remember taking a streetcar to like an empty streetcar to like the end of the city and just like walking around the water treatment plant by myself just for like something to do. And there were these really heavy, like dystopian moments like that. Like I'd never seen like just empty streetcars going by or like no one on the street or like all these boarded up stores or going to like, you know, Shoppers Drug Marts and seeing empty all shelves. The paper and empty shelves and like people like in their windows, like looking outside, you know, going for these night walks with trying not to cross people on the street.
The thing about it, I'm happy we didn't talk about the pandemic that much because the truth is, in light of our current situation, I think more people would be more likely to like really love this movie and really feel this movie because it does speak to what we're going through now.
Yeah.
For me, it has almost nothing to do with it, right?
Yeah.
Like for me, it's like it's a cherry on top that he happened to almost perfectly kind of, you know, predict our last year and a half.
Except just like cool because. This is all about going towards people and being with your friends and family members and
sitting on a street
with like hundreds of people, you know, going crazy and rioting, like imagine the end of the world, but you can't even be close to anybody.
But there were still, you know, we had our riots, we had our crazy shit. Like this last year and a half has been wild, but this movie, you're right. It's like an anecdote. It's like an anecdote to that. Or an antidote. It's more like an antidote. It's more like an antidote than an antidote. okay. So.
Didn't see this in 99. Didn't know this movie
existed. Didn't know this existed. Was kind of excited to see it. Not really. I vacillated a little bit with my final score. I started at a 98. I went down to a 96 and then I woke up the next day and I said, fuck it. It's a 98 for me. Like, this is so good. I said, it's a 98. I said, this movie is so powerful and so poignant that, and I've said some stuff during the podcast that any nitpicky things that I've had melted away entirely in the final act, a brilliant, devastatingly beautiful final act, a triumphant final act, bewilderingly beautiful, truly might be my favorite film we've done yet. It's a 99. I went up as high as I can go. I think it is my favorite film we've done. We haven't done my two favorite films going into this.
Correct.
Being John Malkovich and Magnolia. This is like Magnolia at half the running time for me.
Because Magnolia has the frogs and everything.
Yeah.
It is like Magnolia at half the running time.
Lean Canadian Magnolia.
Yeah, it's like a lean Canadian Magnolia. Which is great. It is
kind of like the Magnolia of Canadian celebrities. If you know,
that's true too.
The Magnolia Canadian celebrities. Callum Keith Rennie is our Tom Cruise. Dominic Keller.
Is that true?
He might be.
He's not.
He's very handsome. He's very handsome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I never thought about it that way, Jim.
She's Julianne Moore, you know, level.
Sure.
Sandra was incredible. It's the best performance I've seen her give and the best female performance of this year, without question for me. I guess I it'll be interesting when we do Magnolia, which over the course of this year, in retrospect, has become my favorite film of this year. We talk about it a lot more than we talk about Being John Malkovich. And Being John Malkovich almost means nothing to me at this point. I don't even think it's my favorite Spike Jonze film or my favorite Charlie Kaufman film at this point. Like, I think it's third for me, right? I think Eternal Sunshine and Adaptation, I like more at this point, right?
Okay.
So all that goes a long way of saying I expect this to kind of be this or Magnolia to be my favorite film going into the end of this year. I it's very weird seeing a movie you love this much at this age. Like, it's fucking bizarre. I think people are like are very hesitant to say that when they see it. It's almost impossible. I haven't seen a movie I like this much since The Social Network. Like, that's the last time I can remember being like, being like, this is just a film that like will forever be a part of me. And like Parasite, maybe, and Moonlight, maybe.
Sure.
But
sure.
Like, no. Like, just no. This is
You'll this never is hear Juan Terramera the same again.
This is the best first watch I've had in forever. This is my favorite viewing experience. I almost watched it again last night with Laura just to like help her like understand. I explained the entire plot to her on text a moment after the movie. Like because I'm downstairs, she's upstairs. I should read the text. I'm going to read the text I sent to you.
Read the text.
And because it's this late in the podcast, my parents are definitely not still listening anymore. So this is an attempt to give you an understanding of like why I'm being so effusive when it comes to this film. Because like, I mean, obviously I text with my wife all day, but so this is fucking Sunday night, but I'm getting, all right. So, all right, here I go. Wow. Are you guys ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
This movie I'm watching just turned incredibly profound and reminded me a ton of me. It's a brilliant movie. It's called Last Night. Point is, you're the only one I care about. And this is, that's a fan. Wait, all right, so that's a different thing. She told me about a dream she had in the middle of it. So there's some things that are happening. All right. You're the only one I care about. I can tell you better. You can watch. It's the last night. All right. So she had tell me about it. I said, it's the last night of world. The last night on earth. The world's going to end at midnight. We follow this one guy who seems pretty melancholy. We meet his family and they're all over him. It's like my family. So passive aggressive, bordering on mean, clearly obsessed with him. He isn't going to spend the last minutes with him. He befriends Sandra Oh and they become friendly. She has her own shit. But basically it started to occur to me that if the world was ending, I wouldn't care as much. I wouldn't care that much if I were him because I don't really care that much about most people. And then she says, tell me about the girl you lost. She died, right? It's pretty obvious. And he says, yes, and kind of breaks down and says, you'd have to meet my family and understand. But she showed me how to love, and it turns out I have a lot of love to give, which, well, that's me. And then he starts about how she died, and I started thinking about you. She just texted me in the middle of this, so I have to go all the way back. hold on. Hang on. All right. So I started thinking about you.
Technology, guys.
Yeah, I know.
Technology.
Yeah. Fuck is it? So I'm sure it's somewhere. All right. All right. Yeah. Says I love me. All right. Which that's me. Oh, I started thinking about you. If you die, the world might as well end too. I'd probably want it to end. It would seem fitting in a way, not kill myself, just that it all should end. So that's why I'm so profoundly affected by this. And I think it explained my life. I hope that's not too intense, but we're married. And then I think I texted her later or talked to her later.
What did she text back?
Did she text back?
She texted back so sad. She texted back, well, that's very sweet. Oh. And then we have other things because then I think I talked more about it later. Or maybe I talked to her in person about it. But
I mean, we've been doing this podcast for a while, Kenny, and I have to say that it, the power of cinema, you know, like
power of cinema,
it really is. We've been doing this for a while, and these movies hit us in all sorts of different ways, and it's just wonderful that I've watched movies that I've never seen before. You've watched movies that you've never seen before, and it can just absolutely blindside you. It's amazing.
Before I ask Chandler for a score, I'm going to say one last thing. I love doing this podcast, but it has made me a very much outside member of this thing called Film Twitter. And what Film Twitter has done to me and what Film Twitter has done to us is it has taken us all, because most people in film, you know, in and around or whatever you would call Film Twitter, are either filmmakers or critics or aspiring filmmakers or aspiring critics or film journalists or people who think about film outside of what made us love film in the beginning. I didn't love film growing up because I admired a certain shot or a certain, you know, plot mechanic or a plot mechanism or anything like that. I loved it because of the way it made me feel. And sometimes we lose sight of that. And when you and I, Phil, we watch, you know, 3 to 4 films a week for this podcast. We watch films for our own writing. We watch films for our own alleged pleasure. But all I really do is fucking analyze them. You get you very much lose sight of like what you loved about film. Mm-hmm. And what this did was actually break through all of that bullshit that I'm always doing, like where I'm watching films or movies or television shows like a coach and stopping it and explaining it to someone and actually let me like really engage with a piece of art in a way that changed me. And I, so
it, what more can you ask for?
It has been the best experience I've had in terms of the best artistic experience I've had in a decade. It's that's it. It's, all right.
That's amazing. Chandler, what's your score back in the day and before and after podcast?
I mean, I really profoundly loved this movie back then, but I was mm-hmm. probably at an 85. Yeah. But I think honestly, Kenny, this conversation, you Sandra owed me or
I made you love this movie.
Yeah, like you gave me a reason to make me love it in a way that profoundly has shaped me and changed me forever. And I now have a more powerful relationship to Last Night than I did before. Aww. So thank you for that. Even though I watched it on the CBC Gem website where literally every 20 minutes there was an advertisement about like
vaccinations.
And don't die.
Yeah. But by the end of it, I was weeping like and just as profoundly moved as I ever have before. So yeah, I mean, I wasn't like there is a cynicism to it and there is a kind of like bland Canadian civility that sort of like humorous but also kind of dark, and there kind of has all the hallmarks of what we think of with Canadian cinema, which is like violence and weird sex and quirky. Sure. And oddness and coldness mixed with like extreme reserves of warmth and passion that are just hidden all the time because we're too afraid to express ourselves. But that ending is so transcendent. You're right. It is one of the most powerful and beautiful endings like in a movie ever. And it's just, I really tip my roots cap to Don McKellar, to my countryman, Don McKellar, for making such a beautifully created first feature. Like it's just so hard to do. And he really did an extraordinary job. And I don't know if he's, the Red Violin is incredible too. I think he'll really enjoy it, but yeah, this is his best film for sure.
What do you give it? What's your number?
Really something special. Yeah. What's your number now?
A 91.
Sweet. Okay. It's great. That's cool. So next week, Chandler, we're doing a movie that I don't know if you've seen. Have you seen the film Pushing Tim?
Oh, Pushing
Tim. I haven't seen. Is it about golf?
No, it's about
you're thinking Tim airplane. Cup, right?
It's about people who work at an airplane traffic control center.
Oh, is Kevin Costner?
That's what Pushing Tim is. They're pushing planes around.
Oh,
it's Billy Bob
John Cusack. John Cusack, Billy Bob Thornton, Angelina Jolie, Kate Blanchett.
Damn.
This is a weird movie.
Angelina Jolie and Billy Bob Thornton.
That's where they met.
All right. So I have a trivia question. I have a trivia question for you, Chandler, because I think Phil might know the answer to this.
Okay.
Three of those four actors, at some point in my life, I would consider like one of my favorite actors ever.
Yeah.
Three of those four actors, I think, are like very, very important to me. Who's the fourth?
Who's the fourth?
Yeah, who's the one I don't consider very important to me?
Wait, who's in the cast? Billy Bob Thornton, John Cusack, Angelina Jolie, and
Cate Blanchett.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say Cate Blanchett.
Correct. That's why I'm not a fit for film Twitter.
Because you don't like Carol.
No, I think she's fantastic and I think she's an amazing actor, but I'm a Say Anything kid and I'm like, Sling Blade was like the first smart guy movie I had ever seen. And I think Angelina Jolie is like our greatest actress ever. So that's me.
Wow.
But I mean, said that on this podcast before.
Being John Malkovich, that's an incredible performance by him.
A movie that, you know, we talked obviously a little bit about being John Malkovich in the past, but I forget that it's John Cusack and Cameron Diaz in that movie. Like, I forget that it's them it's transformative performances from both of them.
And Catherine Keener in that movie, that is the most, like, savviest, I mean, sexiest, coolest woman ever been.
Kenny and I often talk about how we're drawn towards
Mean Girls.
Big Face Means.
And she is the meanest.
Yeah. But she's ultimately not interested in us, I think. But
yeah, correct.
But we've also said
like that's the pathological user in that movie. She'll use
the best, it. The best. Nothing better.
It's looking for that's, a body to climb inside of.
Again, that's why I love Gone Girl so much. Mm-hmm. We've also said. I mean, Chandler, I think you're right on this tip. Like, that's my famous. My favorite supporting actress performance, like ever.
She should have won. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's amazing. And like, as a woman that is covered in freckles, I'm so happy that she exists for us.
Amazing. Yeah,
you just missed a Julianne Nicholson performance too.
So. Yeah, a lot of freckles in Julianne Nicholson. Yeah. So next week we're doing Pushing 10 with Ryan Marker, co-host, co-creator of Screen Drafts. So he's going to come on and talk with us about that. I've been looking forward, weirdly. I don't know, Kenny, if I've said this to you, but Pushing 10 has been one of those films I've actually been really looking forward to doing because it is a very strange film with four giant stars, a movie that doesn't exist. Like, if you took a poll, people would be like, I didn't know this movie existed.
It's also, you know, it's a movie fit for Joe Reed's podcast because it is a movie people had Oscar aspirations for that didn't really...
Mm-hmm. It
didn't really take off.
It is the only feature script written by the Charles brothers who created Cheers.
Wow.
Whoa.
So,
and MASH, I think.
Did they? Les Charles?
I don't know.
It's their only script. I guess it's their only feature idea that they ever had, which I think is hilarious. And it's based on an article they read about the mental anguish that air traffic controllers go through, which is that you actually can't do it for too long. At a certain point, you have to leave the profession because of insurance purposes. There's fear that like you might actually like crash planes.
Wow.
And it's just an incredibly stressful job.
They didn't create MASH. They just wrote on MASH, but and Taxi.
There you go.
But yeah.
It's a weird movie, Chandler. I think you might like it. but I haven't seen it since 99, which I saw in the theater. It's weird. Anyway, Chandler, more than anything, thank you so much for being here, for coming and talking about, coming on here, talking about Last Night with us. You're our fellow Torontonian.
Thank you. Anytime Chandler's Polly's in the movie, I'll be there.
This was the last one of 99.
There was another Canadian film that it was Felicia's Journey. Chandler's going to think I do this on every podcast. I've done this twice.
Only for Chandler's movies.
Those are really the only two new films that were completely new to me that I've like gone gaga for. There are others I've really liked, but I really like Guinevere. I think it's a great film.
Yeah, Guinevere is great.
The funny thing is that Chandler was supposed to, she was going to come on to be a guest for Sex, Lies, and Videotape, but because she was filming her movie, we recorded that with also an illustrious guest, Jessica Ellis. It was a great episode.
A great filmmaker.
But had Chandler been here for Sex, Lies, and Videotape, you would have been 3 for 3.
I love that movie.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape before?
No, I had.
I've barely seen it like once 20 years
ago. Yeah, I love Sex, Lies, and Videotape, but that doesn't, that doesn't shock me that I love it. Like, that's a movie. That's obviously a pretty, formative movie, a pretty foundational movie for American independent cinema.
Yeah.
But this is this obscure movie that we did that, like, frankly, we kind of cheated to get on the list too.
I think the lobbying for the Criterion release starts here because I think you're right. If In the Mood for Love is going to be on Criterion, an excellent film, this film is just as romantic at the very end.
I got to tell you, Kenny and I talked about this a little bit as well on our Girl on the Bridge episode. Girl on the Bridge, I don't know if you've seen that film, Chandler.
I don't know what that is at all.
I think you would absolutely love that film. It's a Patrice Leconte film. It's absolutely exquisite, without a doubt one of the most romantic movies ever, and they never kiss. It is just
that's the other one I did it for you.
That's
right.
The other one, right? Like, these two movies should be in the Criterion Collection as like the most romantic movies ever, and no one knows they exist. So Let's just keep banging that drum. But if I highly recommend Chandler watching Girl on the Bridge, I think you'd really love it.
Doesn't it bother you to know?
Don't let this detract you from watching Canadian movies. There's lots of good stuff out there.
This is true.
Wet your whistle. Check out the IMDb. Mm-hmm. You know.
And you've got Chandler's movie coming out soon. At some point.
I'll definitely watch your.
We'll definitely be watching that. But
that's the biggest. That's the biggest takeaway of. I mean, aside from the film, but the biggest global takeaway here is there are probably millions of movies that have been made, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of features. We've seen such a small fraction of them, and you have no idea of where your favorite film is right now.
Sure. Yes.
You have no idea. That's so it's not even, and I don't even consider myself to be a snob. I watch, you know, or a reverse snob, I guess. I'll watch films. I'll watch any kind of film, experimental film, foreign film. I search out great films. I want to be affected by, I'm affected like this.
Yeah.
But you never know. You so you keep trying. Watch every movie from a year. You might find something you love.
I also think that if they remake this, Elliot Page should play Patrick.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting.
They would be incredible.
That'd be cool. I love this movie, and I'm so glad, Kenny, that you loved it too. And Chandler, having you on to talk about it with us was just this. I could not have expected such a wonderful episode. Honestly,
yes, really, thank just you so much. Stuff. It was a transformative conversation.
Cool. There you go.
You're very, Chandler, you're, we can't you're, wait to have you're, you back. You're a great guest, and we can't wait to have you for an 89er.
All right,
or 99er, but for the Patreon.
Okay.
We'd love to have
you. Okay.
Right. Bye, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.